He noticed it particularly because it seemed very heavy for one man to carry. This box was placed over to one side of the compartment that he and the engineer occupied. The pilot warmed up the engines and everything seemed satisfactory prior to takeoff. They took off in the B-25 and started climbing up to a safe altitude. In the neighborhood of 15 to 20 minutes after the takeoff, it was noticed that the left engine was on fire. Sergeant Matthews, the engineer, followed some emergency procedure and seemed worried. Later I found out that what he had actually done was pull the value on the emergency firefighting system for that engine. It did not work. Then Lieutenant Brown, or as this fellow put it, the tall co-pilot, squeezed through the doorway and commanded them to strap on their parachutes. There were parachutes for all of them there. Lieutenant Brown had his harness on but did not have his parachute snapped to his harness. He harshly commanded them both to jump. Lieutenant Brown quickly told him how to pull the ripcord, then he was sure he was clear the ship and actually forcibly shoved him out of the plane into the night. His parachute opened okay. For some 9 to 11 minutes, while floating down to Earth, he watched the burning engine and the airplane as it proceeded high above him and to the south. He assumed that all aboard had parachuted. He landed, knew he had hurt his leg, and some people brought him to the hospital. By that time Smith and I knew that both Davidson and Brown had crashed and died with the plane. We did not tell Ted Morlow their names. In fact, I think the only thing we said was, "Wow! What an experience!" We were completely non-committal, still keeping our mouths shut. Ted Morlow made no attempt to pry information out of us but tried as hard as he could to make us understand he was our friend. The whole business had gotten so far out of hand, he said, that he was now only interested in our personal safety. It was satisfactory with him if we did not talk about anything that had transpired. I recall Morlow making the remark, "I'll tell you, boys, when my informants can't get information in this neck of the woods, brother, there's sure something wrong." We felt that Morlow meant what he was saying. We thanked him kindly for letting us listen over the recorded interview, got Smithy's car out of the garage across the street from the hotel and drove down to the pier where we were met by Chrisman. We all walked out on the pier and down the stairway to Chrisman's boat. I took movies of the boat and of Captain Smith looking at the superstructure, then I went aboard the boat, too. This was the boat that Chrisman said the damage had happened to. It was kind of a grayish color, a very small type of partially enclosed inboard fishing boat. It in no wise looked like harbor patrol boats that I had seen in pictures. After inspecting the boat, we could see where some repairs had apparently taken place, but nothing like the repairs to damage as described by either Fred Chrisman or Dahl in the hotel room had led us to expect. We questioned Chrisman further about the photographs that Dahl had taken of the strange craft on Maury Island. Chrisman said, "I don't know what could have happened to those pictures. I couldn't find them around my office. I looked everywhere. Apparently I've taken them up to my mountain cabin along with a number of other things I took up there a while back." He suggested that we drive up there and see. I acted polite enough in declining his invitation but thought to myself, "How big a sucker do you think I am?" After inspecting the top surface and cabin of the boat, Captain Smith and I went down to the engine room. A rather foreign-looking gentleman of slight build was tinkering with something on the motor. He made the remark to Fred Chrisman that the engine wouldn't work. I know that I thought it was a pretty junky-looking affair and apparently ill taken care of. While Captain Smith was standing in the doorway, the mechanic took Chrisman by the arm, pulled him to one side, and whispered to him. Chrisman turned to us and said, "The mechanic's having a hard time getting the engine going. It'll take him about an hour to repair it." The engine did not look like a bolt or a screw had been turned on it. Captain Smith and I both noticed that. I think I know something about motors, and I know Captain Smith does. Not only did this seem fishy to us, but frankly, I wouldn't travel 100 yards to sea in a boat in that condition. I think Smithy thought the same thing because he motioned to me and said, "Let's go back uptown." We gave up the idea of going to Maury Island, at least in that kind of contraption. Fred Crisman seemed a little apologetic, but didn't say anything further. As we left in Smith's car, Crisman yellowed at us that he would call us as soon as the boat was repaired. He still thought, I guess, that we wanted to go to Maury Island in his boat. That was the last time I ever saw Fred Crisman. Captain Smith and I were both thoroughly disgusted with our continuance of the investigation. We had lunch uptown and returned to the hotel, I guess in kind of a daze. We met Paul Lance in the hotel lobby briefly and continued to our room. I suggested that we take some of the fragments and send them to ourselves by mail or something of that kind, but we took no action. I also suggested we put some movie film and place it next to these fragments that were strewn all over the room to see if anything about them would cause white spots on unexposed film. Certainly if they were radioactive, this would substantiate that Crisman had the photographs as Harold Darland he claimed. Somehow we didn't do anything about that, either. I did take my movie camera which had some unexposed film in it and laid it on top of the dresser next to a bunch of the fragments. I might mention here that when my film was developed there were no white spots on it or black ones either. All of my pictures turned out very well. Captain Smith and I just sat around, wondering what in the dickens the score was. Finally the telephone rang. It was Ted Morello. This mysterious informant had phoned again and now he was predicting things. He said this man just told him on the other line that Captain Smith would be called Tuesday, August 5th, to Wright Patterson Field, Dayton, Ohio to be interrogated by military intelligence. He told him that Kenneth Arnold's plane had been shot at while flying over Washington and Oregon on numerous occasions and that Captain Smith's airliner had also been shot at over Montana. He went on to tell Morello that the B-25 bomber from Hamilton Field had been shot down by a 20mm cannon. A recent crash at LaGuardia Field, New York was caused by sabotage, he claimed, the gust locks having been left on purposely to sabotage the plane. Also the passenger transport that crashed carrying singer Grace Moore to her death in Copenhagen, Denmark, had similarly been sabotaged. Ted Morello said that he would like to see us that evening if we would be kind enough to come over to the press room. This is what I later found out about the above predictions. Captain Smith told me that he was not called Wright Patterson nor was he interrogated by military intelligence. If either of our places were shot at in the air, it was something of which we were unaware. The official military explanation of the B-25 bomber was that it was simply an accident caused by the loss of an exhaust collector ring on the left engine. It was never completely explained by the military why Lieutenant Frank M. Brown and Captain William Davidson did not notify anyone by radio signifying their distress nor why they hadn't parachuted also. According to the hitchhiker's remark, a good 10 minutes elapsed between the time he was shoved out of the B-25 until the fire reached serious proportions and the plane started to dive to earth near Kelso, Washington. The estimated altitude of his jump was 10,000 feet. It takes a long time to descend from that height by parachute. Staying from his chute, he said he watched the burning plane a long time before getting near the earth. Regarding the prediction that Captain Smith's airliner had been shot at over Montana, that was wrong as he did not fly over Montana. Concerning the airline crash on takeoff at LaGuardia Field, about a month after this it was determined by the Civil Aeronautics Administration and their investigators that the gust locks had been left on accidentally. I was unable to find any official explanation of the Copenhagen crash. Chapter 5. Get Out For Your Own Good. By the afternoon of the 1st of August, 1947, both Captain Smith and I were wanting to heed Ted Morello's advice and leave town. We expected, however, to be contacted by military intelligence regarding Brown and Davidson, so decided to stay another day. We were sure there would be some kind of investigation. In the course of our frightening experiences, I had sent a number of wires to my wife, Doris, in Boise that frightened her as to my safety. I called long distance to my mother in Albany, Oregon, telling my brother who answered the phone that I didn't know if I would see them again but wanted them to know where I was. In fact, I was so suspicious of somebody recording my conversations that I asked my brother to take my mother out in the yard and tell her that I felt in extreme danger of some kind. I've thought since that this was slightly senseless. I could only have caused them undue worry. Then, again, maybe it was the best thing I ever did. Mother often prayed for my safety. She never has had as much confidence in an airplane as in an automobile. I guess I wanted some kind of help, but for the life of me I didn't know what kind of help I wanted, nor did I have the least idea to where to ask for it. I knew that Doris was doing all that she could to rescue me from the situation. I could tell when I phoned her that she felt I needed rescuing from something. Captain Smith was also doing some phoning and letter writing, but I don't know what it was about. I'll never forget when I went out the door of the room to go downstairs to buy a packet of cigarettes. I had to walk down 5 flights. That same day all the hotel help had gone on strike and the Hotel Winthrop was being picketed. I sure thought that town had gone haywire. Everything seemed to be topsy-turvy. Upon purchasing my cigarettes at the newsstand, I saw and brought the final edition of the Tacoma Times newspaper. It had just been delivered. Large block type headlines red ink stated, "Sabotage hinted in crash off Army bomber at Kelso," and a subheadline read, "Plane may hold flying disc secret." The story was written by Paul Lance, the reporter we had refused to talk to. The following is taken verbatim out of the August 2, 1947 final edition of the Tacoma Times. The mystery of the flying saucers soared into prominence again Saturday when the Tacoma Times was informed that the crash Friday of an army plane at Kelso may have been caused by sabotage. The Times informant, in a series of mysterious phone calls, reported that the ship had been sabotaged or shot down to prevent shipment of flying disc fragments to Hamilton Field, California, for analysis. The disc parts were said by the informant to be those from one of the mysterious platters which plunged to Earth on Maury Island recently. Lending substance to the caller's story is the fact that 12 hours before the Army released official identification, he correctly identified the dead in the crash to be Captain William L. Davidson, pilot, and First Lieutenant Frank M. Brown. Classified material. At the same time, he informed the Times, Kenneth Arnold, Boise businessman who first sighted the flying saucers, and United Airlines Captain E.J. Smith, who also sighted them, were in secret conference in room 502 at the Hotel Winthrop. A check confirmed the information, but neither Smith nor Arnold would disclose the nature of the conference nor the reason for their being in Tacoma. According to the anonymous caller, platter fragments were loaded aboard a B-25 at McCord Field Friday for shipment to the California field. Half an hour after the takeoff, the plane crashed near Kelso, Washington. Two enlisted men, Master Sergeant Elmer L. Taff and Technician 4th Grade Woodrow D. Matthews, parachuted to safety. At McCord Field, an intelligence officer confirmed the mystery caller's report that the ill-fated craft had been carrying classified material. Hint: sabotage. Major George Sander explained, "Classified material means there was a somewhat secret cargo aboard the plane. No one was allowed to take pictures of the wreckage until the material was removed and returned to McCord Field." He declined to say what constituted classified material. The theory of sabotage was borne out by the statement of the two crash survivors that one of the engines burst into flames and that regular fire apparatus installed in the engine for such emergencies failed to function. Names revealed. Notified of the information passed along by the anonymous informant, Captain Smith said, "When the story breaks, it will be given general release, but it will not come from this room." At the time he was in the Hotel Winthrop in conference with Arnold Saturday, Smith and he and Arnold would deny anything that was printed about the secret sessions held in the hotel. However, he was visibly disturbed and expressed consternation when notified late Saturday that the names of the dead pilot and co-pilot had been revealed before the Army released them. According to the telephone callers, Both the dead officers were members of military intelligence at Hamilton Field. Due to the fact that this newspaper was printed and on the stands Friday evening, August 1st, but was distributed to their subscribers the next morning, Saturday the 2nd, the references to happenings on Saturday actually were happenings of Friday, August 1st. The statement that Captain Smith and Visible disturbed is referring to earlier that same day when Captain Smith and I returned to the hotel after inspecting Fred Crisman's boat. Paul Lance met us in the lobby, tried to talk to us, and Smith made the statement referred to. We were delayed by 2 minutes by Paul Lance. I took this paper up to Captain Smith. I don't know how he felt, but I was plain scared. This whole thing had long since ceased to be laughing matter under any circumstances. We attempted to reach Fred Crisman at the phone number he had given us when we did not receive the call from him that his boat had been repaired. There was no answer. We attempted to reach Harold Dahl. There was no answer. We sent out a dragnet of calls to all the theaters and places we thought Dahl might frequent. Finally we reached him. When he arrived at our hotel he told us that Crisman had left a message saying he was going to have to be gone for a few days. Right after Dahl told us that, Morello called and told that the mysterious telephone informant had just notified him that Fred L. Crisman had boarded an army bomber that afternoon and was now being flown to Alaska. Morello asked us if we knew whether this was true. We were simply flabbergasted when we called McCordfield and found out that an army bomber had taken off that afternoon for Alaska. There was no way that we could check who the passengers or personnel were aboard it. You never saw such a confused bunch of guys in your life as we three were. Another thing seemed rather peculiar. With people disappearing and getting killed, Harold Dahl has been calmly sitting in a movie theater all afternoon. He had been notified before he went to the movie by Crisman and by his radio as to what had happened in the last 12 or 14 hours. All Smithy could do was stand and shake his head. I wanted to stick my head out of the window and scream. We sat Dahl down in a chair and told him firmly that we didn't want him to disappear. Both of us were positive that military intelligence at either McCord or Hamilton Field would be interviewing us soon. We were the reason that the two intelligence officers had come to Tacoma, and we were the last people to see them alive outside of military personnel. We figured they would want to talk to all three of us. Harold promised us that he would be handy. We told him to return to his show if he wished. We just wanted to be sure he knew what had taken place. He left. Captain Smith and I went out to supper before going over to see Ted Morello. Ted Morello was as hospitable a person as you could ever meet. He showed us every courtesy. He invited us into a black room just off a small glass tin area where the newswire teletype machine was ticking off news events from different parts of the country. After closing the door, he made it clear that he didn't intend to print anything about all this, but we wanted us to know what he had been up against and to give us some advice. Smithy and I sat and listened. Ted Morello said, "When I first heard about you fellows being in town, I really didn't think much about it. Paul Lance was the one who smelled a story. Then his mysterious telephone informant kept calling and pestering the life out of us. We tried every conceivable way to trace his calls with no success. We really tried. We tried to find out information at McCord Field and drew a blank, and we have informants out there who practically smell the runways for news." He stopped a moment, then asked, "Did you know the B-25 that stopped the other day was under military armed guard every minute it was at the field?" Captain Smith and I said no and shook our heads. Ted Morello continued, "I don't know how to impress upon you two fellows that I am not after a news story now. You're involved in something that is beyond our power here to find out anything about. We're exhausted every avenue attempting to piece what has happened together so it makes some sense. I'm just giving you some sound advice. Go out of this town until whatever it is blows over. If you want to talk anything over with me, I will give you my promise that it won't be printed. I'm concerned with your welfare. I think you are nice fellows and I don't want to see anything happen to you if I can prevent it." He went into the teletype room and tore off a recent release from the Upwire. Earlier that day, Dick Rankin, a famous pilot, had sent word over the wires that Davidson and Brown had talked to him about his reports of flying saucers. He felt that Davidson and Brown were really hot on the trail of finding out what the saucers were and, for some reason, he appeared to think their lives were in danger. Apparently his wire release over UP was with the intention of notifying Brown and Davidson to get some place of safety. No place in the release that I remember did it announce or let on that he knew Davidson or Brown had been killed. Dick Rankin could be classified as an authority of aviation matters. He learned to fly in 1920 under the tutelage of his brother, Tex Rankin, who was known in his time as the world's foremost stunt pilot. In many respects, Dick was every bit as good a pilot as his brother, Tex. He did everything from wing walking in 1924 to becoming an A No. 1 stunt pilot and won every contest that he entered in 1929, 1930 and 1931. Dick could do almost everything in the book when it came to handling an airplane. He once performed an outside loop with an OX-5 Waco. That was an outstanding feat in the early days of flying. Even most modern aircraft were restricted against such a maneuver, let alone the courage a pilot must have to attempt it. In order to give the reader some background and possibly more meaning to the Dick Rankin news release that Ted Murillo read to Captain Smith and me, I am going to quote from an article written by Evelyn Whitmaker and published in The Air Traveler in September 1948. Dick Rankin was not only an expert in the field of aviation but had unusual extrasensory perception that many people would rank in the believe it or not category. Dick's life was once saved by a dream. He was always having dreams, which the next morning he would tell Tex, or Jack, as he called Tex. The latter used to get quite provoked at Dick and his crazy dreams and sometimes would walk away, refusing to listen. The morning after Dick had this particular dream, in 1928, Dick arrived at the old Portland flouring mills and reported to Tex that he refused to fly his ship until the tail assembly had been examined, as he had had a dream that he and his student were killed due to broken wires in the tail assembly. Again Tex scoffed and proceeded to ignore Dick, after telling him to stop being silly and to take care of his students. This time, however, Dick refused to be so easily pushed aside. He would not fly until the fabric was ripped from the tail and the controls carefully examined, since the dream was too vivid to ignore. Hot words flew between the two brothers but Dick won out, simply because Tex figured he would cure Dick once and for all of his silly dreams. Dick slashed the linen with his penknife and discovered 3 control wires severed and the 4th ready to give way. Tex stated that had Dick and his student taken off with the ship in that condition, they would have been killed on the first round. Tex was amazed, but Dick wasn't. Tex told all of us at the airport that never again would he laugh at Dick and his dreams. To me it was also unusual to find that as a result of an automobile accident in 1940, Dick is today partially paralyzed from the hips down. In knowing this about Dick Rankin, I caught myself wondering by what queer quirk of fate did physically handicapped people become directly associated with my life and flying saucers. There was Paul Lance, Ted Morello and now Dick Rankin, all through disease or accident affected from the waist down and all appeared to want desperately to offer a helping hand. I am quite sure that Captain Smith was not familiar with Dick Rankin as he didn't offer to talk about him. I recall bringing up the subject several times that evening. I had flown with Tex Rankin, not too long before his crash and untimely death at Klamath Falls, Oregon. Somehow I placed a good deal of credence on Dick's opinion. I knew that Tex admired his brother and I don't think there's a pilot in the country who didn't admire Tex. We thank Ted Morillo for his kindness and we did confirm a number of things he asked us about. We both felt better as we left the building. We felt we had found a real friend in Ted Morillo and for some reason even Paul Lance's approaches were no longer interpreted as just a reporter looking for a story. We went back across the street to the hotel where I sent several wires and Smithy spent about an hour writing letters. I don't remember how many calls had been left in the form of notes in our hotel box. I do know that the important call we were expecting from military intelligence was not there. We picked up our key at the desk and proceeded to walk up 5 flights to our room. That long evening of August 1st, Captain Smith and I simply sat around the room and looked at each other, every minute expecting military intelligence to get in touch with us. I recall Dave Johnson of the Idaho Statesman phoning and wanting to know what we were doing. He was so insistent I turned the phone over to Captain Smith, and finally Smithy admitted to Dave that we had been seeing Dahl and Crisman and had been in conference with military intelligence. He told him that Captain William Davidson and Lieutenant Frank M. Brown were the intelligence officers who had been there and that now they were dead. By no means could we not did we attempt to tell him the complete story. Captain Smith also told Morris Roddy of the Chicago Tribune practically the same thing when he phoned. I never could figure out why Smithy said, "We only have 6 pieces of fragments." These fragments were still strewn all over the room. I figured that if he said we had a whole pile of them, we'd probably be overrun by souvenir hunters. I think Captain Smith thought 6 was a good round figure. Neither of us had actually counted the number of fragments we had. That night we went to bed feeling pretty clammy and cold inside. Somehow the leaky faucet song that we laughed at so hilariously the night before didn't seem funny anymore. All we did the next day, Saturday, August 2nd, was hang around the room, going out only to eat, anticipating a call every minute from either McCord or Hamilton Field. Smithy phoned McCord Field and talked to someone there in the intelligence division, telling them exactly where we were if they wanted to see us. I remember him hanging up the phone with a rather discouraged look on his face. We wanted someone to talk to us and there we sat like a couple of dead ducks. We didn't know if the fragments were worth sending home to ourselves. We had given up trying to get to Maury Island, and though we were positive that Harold Dahl's story was true in many respects, it seemed our efforts had been wasted. Outside of the fragments on the floor, we couldn't prove a thing. We were utterly confused and frustrated. In the afternoon, Harold Dahl stopped by for a brief visit, not having very much to say. He left after inviting us to breakfast the next morning at a small cafe along the main highway from Seattle to Portland on the eastern outskirts of Tacoma. I thought several times that day that I should go out to Barry's airport and inspect my airplane. I phoned out there and everything seemed to be all right and my plane hadn't been disturbed. We did absolutely nothing but wait the rest of the day. As far as we knew, nothing further happened that shed any light on the mystery of the whole business. We decided we should stay there until the military did get in touch with us. Captain Smith mentioned before he went to sleep that night that he simply had to get back on his airline runs or he was going to be out of a job. I don't know how many flights he can cancel. At this point I would like to impress upon the reader that these events, people, and places are not fictional nor ghost stories nor figments of my imagination. Not only can every person involved verify this to be the truth, but I have hotel receipts, newspapers, and photographs to substantiate this that I have written as being true. The next morning, August 3rd, was bright and sunny. The weather while we were in Tacoma was exceptionally good. The visibility was wonderful. We could see Maury Island out across the bay from our hotel window. In fact, photographing it from our northwest window was as close as I ever got to it. I remember remarking to Captain Smith that if we didn't get out of that hotel room pretty soon, the suspense would drive us crazy. About 9 o'clock we met Harold Dahl and his secretary at the little roadside cafe. We all had bacon and eggs. While we were eating, Captain Smith suddenly got up and went to the payphone. He made a call to someone, then came back to the booth and told me he was going to be gone for about an hour. I asked him where he was going. "I'm sorry, Ken," he said, "I can't tell you. But you return to the hotel and stay in the room and wait for me and don't leave the room under any circumstances. Lock the doors. I'll be back to the hotel not later than 12 o'clock noon. You've got to trust me and don't worry about me coming up missing or something." I was glad he said that, but somehow I was so spooked I didn't believe he'd ever get back. The investigation had gotten underway with 6 men and now there were only 3 of us. Harold Dahl appeared to be of us to be kind of shaky. We didn't think he'd last long in a pinch. For the last 2 days we had definitely felt a misgiving of a feeling of oppression like a dark cloud had encompassed our minds.